Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Coming up on Weekend America.
This weekend is the last push before Super Duper Tuesday. That's when about 24 states will hold primaries. Whose brainchild was that?
Nobody coordinated the activities of all these other states. They just did it on their own.
This hour, we'll explore the birth order of primaries. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. Politics has always inspired music.
You know, once I got my hook that I was going to portray all the candidates as, you know, people who drink the blood of infants, that was exciting to me. You know?
Later, the Mountain Goats christen the season with a song. And at one time, the idea of black history was shocking.
You mean there's an entire week's worth of material? Some people couldn't even imagine what you could talk about for a whole week in terms of African-American accomplishments.
Coming up, little-known black history facts that they never taught you in school. Up ahead on Weekend America.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend, we're surrounded by super-duperness. The football game Sunday, the presidential voting on Tuesday. What would it take to make your weekend? Well, you know.
My weekend would be super if my restaurant decided to close on Super Bowl Sunday so I could do as I pleased.
What would make my weekend super is if the 49ers were playing.
If the Patriots lose the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, is this weekend the Super Bowl?
My weekend is super. I have good things planned, and the Super Bowl isn't really one of them, but I do plan to vote.
All my work would be done on Friday, so I could relax and probably cook.
What would make my weekend super is home-cooked food, because dorm food is terrible.
Mom, where's that care package?
Those voices came to us from Denver, Colorado, Boise, Idaho, and Anchorage, Alaska, all states participating in Super Tuesday.
Well, I know it would make this weekend a super one for the presidential candidates for their last-minute campaigning to pay off on Super Tuesday. It's hard to see how candidates are going to have the time, the money to cover the ground between North Dakota and Georgia, New York, California, much less address the concerns of such diverse voters all in one day. Barbara Norander is a political science professor at the University of Arizona, and she's written about regional politics and presidential primaries. She says there's a good reason the primary process has just gotten so complicated. Barbara, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, we have more states than ever in history having a primary on the same day. It's like a primary palooza. How did this happen?
Well, it mostly happened by accident. You had individual legislatures changing the date of their presidential primary or their caucus to move up to the beginning of February, which was sort of the first legal date, according to the political parties, that they could adopt a primary. Mm-hmm. And everybody wanted to be first. And as a result, you got about 24, 25 states on the same day.
I know we haven't had 24 states on the same day, but we've had Super Tuesdays before.
Yeah, we've had Super Tuesdays since the beginning of the 1980s. And generally, it was just any sort of primary day when there were several states holding primaries on the same time. But back in the 1980s, it was more like a handful of states. And the Super Tuesdays were scheduled in March rather than February. The only really planned Super Tuesday was in 1988 when the southern states coordinated their primaries in hopes that this would give them more clout.
And how did that work out for them?
It didn't work out quite as well as they thought it would, in part because there were five other states that had primaries on that same date or caucuses, so it kind of diluted the effect. And the Democrats, who had been sort of the impetus for this reform, had hoped that a more conservative candidate would win in the Southern Super Tuesday, but it turned out to be a three-way split between Gore, Dukakis, and Jesse Jackson that year.
Should we have learned something from them that they didn't try that one again?
What happened after that was in 1992, a number of the southern states sort of moved away from their regional primary format because they found it cost their state too much in terms of having to fund an extra election, mm-hmm. or because the state legislators didn't want to have their primary so early, or because they just found out that the turnout wasn't as high as they expected, and so some states reverted back to a caucus format.
Would it solve the problem just to not have Iowa and New Hampshire as the first primaries? Is that what people are mostly upset about? Because I hear that argument.
Well, some people are upset about that. Yeah, they think it's a little bit unfair that these two particular states always go first. But those two states go first, again, by accident. They moved their primary and caucus dates earlier in the schedule when it wasn't so important to win early. So if you go back into the 1970s or earlier, it was often more important to win the last round of primaries before the convention rather than the first round. And so nobody really paid that much attention when New Hampshire set its early date.
I don't understand why they would move the date up.
Well, in the early 1900s, when the first round of presidential primaries were adopted, only about 15 states adopted primaries at that time, and they were scattered across the spring months. And New Hampshire adopted a early, I believe it was probably a March date at that time, for their primaries so that it would coincide with their town meetings, and so they wouldn't have to open up the town hall twice. So it was being frugal in terms of conserving energy at the time. And the Iowa caucuses were moved up in the 1970s because they had a sort of a scheduling process where they had to have a variety of events. They have to have the local caucuses and then a county-level convention and a congressional district convention and a state convention. And trying to schedule all those, you know, I think they had a party rule that they had to be about 60 days apart. And just adding all those 60 days up came into January.
Well, Barb, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Barbara Norander is a political science professor at the University of Arizona. She's no football fan, so no Super Bowl for her this weekend. Instead, she plans to look forward to all those primary commercials. Arizona is one of those Super Tuesday states.
So this is the Super Bowl if you're a poli-sci professor.
Exactly.
The weirdness of elections in America, an advanced and modern nation, right? To pay tribute to Tuesday's presidential extravaganza, we have recruited songwriters. This first tune is from the Los Angeles band Hearts of Palm, UK. This is called Simply Super Tuesday. See if you can get this out of your head.
Party nominations to represent our nation. Who you gonna vote for? You know it's Super Tuesday. Super Tuesday. Coming soon to a state near you. In Alabama and Idaho, Georgia and Delaware, Utah and Tennessee, New York, New Mexico. Oklahoma, North Dakota, West Virginia, Minnesota. Obama has got a certain je ne sais quoi, but I've seen him on a few too many TV talk shows. His bill running vicariously through Hillary, and I just found out about Mike Rebell. Elections for party nominations to represent our nation. Who you gonna vote for? You know it's Super Tuesday. Super Tuesday. Coming soon to a state near you. In Arizona and Illinois, Kansas, Montana, California, Connecticut, Alaska, and Arkansas. Like the wind, Cain is really old, so this is his last chance. not what it once was, and so everything costs more. There's a seething war in Iraq. Is it time to bring our troops home? Privatize social security or equal taxes for all? Elections for party nominations to represent our nation. Who you gonna vote for? You know it's Super Tuesday. Super Duper Tuesday. Coming soon to a state near you. Super Tuesday. Super Duper Tuesday, coming soon to a state near you.
Mamma mia, can you say ABBA?
I heard Postal Service meets Education Rock meets the Juno soundtrack. I also heard Camera Obscura, but yeah, come on, tell me that's not catchy. Yeah. That was the LA band Hearts of Palm, UK. With the song Super Tuesday. And yes, of course, you can hear it again. Just visit us at weekendamerica.org.
I have a feeling it'll be, like you said, in my head, I'll be hearing it again, whether I log on or not to our website. But check it out anyway.
Or you can share it, too. You can email it to people when you go to our website. And I would do that, but I'm not you. So stay tuned. We have another musical Super Tuesday tribute for you coming up later this hour.
I wonder what song the Super Tuesday states are going to be singing in 4 years, because I'm not sure they'll agree that bunching up on one day was, you know, a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, you were talking about that earlier. It's a good question. And since no one actually seems to be in charge, how would they change it even if they wanted to?
Yeah, Professor Norander was telling me that, you know, when the primaries are staggered, it's the lesser known candidates that really benefit, because they can raise money for one primary, win there, get some momentum, raise some more money and go forward. But when you have them all on this, you know, super palooza primary date, it's better for candidates that already have high name recognition and lots of money. And so if they don't disaggregate, if they decide to do this again, then that's just going to force what she calls those invisible primaries to start earlier and earlier, where newcomers are going to have to start, you know, a year and a half in advance so that they start the gate, the campaign season, with name recognition and money.
So, well, Super Tuesday is just one benchmark in the long process, the long, long, long process of choosing our next president. We're going to continue to cover this election, and we would like to know what you need to cast an informed vote in November.
Tell us, you know, what are the issues you care about most? And what are the issues that the media is ignoring? You can help us shape our own election coverage.
Yes, your vote counts with us. So spend some time with us at our website and talk about it. We're at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, I'm searching for the ideal family size. So if you know any ideal families, let me know. And stay tuned to Weekend America.
This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This weekend, I'm looking for a birthday gift, ideally with pictures of doggies and the moon. My daughter's turning a year old, and this means my wife and I have started talking about child number two. She's open to it, and I'm eager because I grew up one of nine. And to me, home has always meant a crowded house. However, we also know it's not that simple. We have seen Al Gore's movie, and suddenly my memories of bombing down the highway in a gas-chugging motorhome with 11 people, two seatbelts, and a porta-potty, that just funny, just doesn't seem that responsible anymore. Environmentalist Bill McKibben has thought about this. He wrote a book called Maybe One that makes the case for one-child families. I asked McKibben for his advice.
If you were asking me whether or not you should have another child and you lived in Tanzania, I would tell you that at least from a global warming standpoint, it didn't make much difference. You weren't using enough energy for it to matter. But if you're living in this country and you're living like most Americans do and you think your child will probably grow up to live the way that most Americans do, then those numbers do begin to add up some.
Whatever environmental action we take, it's not going to have a big effect by itself, right? It's a drop in the bucket.
That's right.
Which is fine, and I'll sacrifice a little for a drop in the bucket. I'll recycle, and I take the bus. But if I deeply wanted to produce another child, Bill, wouldn't I be kind of insane to give that up for the sake of the environment?
I think you might. And I think if there are people who really feel like their destiny is to be parents and have another kid, then more power to them. One of the points that I wanted to make was simply that not everybody needed to feel that way.
But most parents do feel that way, McKibben says, because of their stereotypes about only children. The number one reason American parents give for having a second is so that their first kid will not be an only. We tend to think only children are lonely, spoiled, self-centered, socially inept, or all of those. And I had to admit that I hadn't thought it consciously, but somewhere in my desire for a big family lies that feeling that a childhood without siblings is a ripoff. It's a disservice.
One of the most interesting parts of researching this topic was discovering where all those myths came from. There is a single study done in the 1890s, in the birth of sort of psychiatry and sociology, by a very interesting American, a guy named G. Stanley Hall, who developed the first big study of all of this. And he had people collecting stories of only children from all across America and trying to decide whether or not they were peculiar. And so people would send in their results, and they could be peculiar children if they were ugly, or if they were particularly beautiful, or if they had a strong sense of smell. In fact, he didn't limit his data to actual people. He allowed fictional characters as well to be included in his data set. And when he was done with this study, what do you know? The two things he found that were peculiar were only children and children of immigrants.
Since then, there have been many studies that contradict the stereotypes about only children. I hit the library and I read up on the research, and mostly what it convinced me is that reading child psychiatry studies is no way to plan a family. The subject is just too complicated and too subjective to be of any real help. So I sat down with some Weekend America colleagues who were raised as only children, and I asked them what it was like. I spoke with Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, and Mark Sanchez, and all three of them assured me that really it was not miserable. The first voice you hear is Phyllis.
People look at you like, oh, you're an only, you know, and you can see they're thinking you're spoiled, you're all these various things, but I don't really think that's true. I mean, I honestly think there's kind of a maturity that you have because you're around adults all the time and that's who you grow up with. You're used to having the attention, and I personally feel a lot of only children, because they're used to it, you don't seek it as much. I mean, you have it all the time, so you don't go out into the world like, me, me, me. I mean, you come from all of that. You grow up with so much kind of support and love and validation in a way. For example, if I argue with people, I feel like you're free to have your opinion and I'm free to have mine. There's not like the battle to the finish.
I'm exactly like that. When I see people arguing, I'm kind of like, what's the point? I'm more of a listener.
Yeah, I have to say, when I hear people arguing, especially like families, it really freaks me out.
Yeah.
Because my house was very quiet.
Yeah, I agree with
we
Mark.
All grew up in the same house. That's clear.
And they told me about other benefits, too. They all think that being sibling-free made them more independent,
and also adaptive, because only children can't stick with their own tribe, so they learn how to engage the world and fit in with all kinds of outsiders. They also agreed that being an only child feeds your imagination. Instead of playing with your siblings, maybe you're writing or daydreaming. So I was a little surprised when I asked my friends about their ideal family size. None of them have children yet, and all of them said if they do, they'd like at least two kids. And why? Because having a brother or sister sounds like fun, sounds like friendship. They also said it would be nice not to be the only ones taking care of their aging parents. And there was another reason.
My father's passed away, and I think when my mother goes, I feel like I'll be the only one who remembers my childhood. I'll be the only one who's like the keeper of my own flame. It's hard to describe, but I can't turn to anyone and say, hey, remember when we did blah, blah, blah? You know, I can say that about trips, maybe with cousins or something like that, but huge chunk of my life that only the three of us really shared, you know, there'll be nobody to talk to about that. And it's kind of a strange feeling. Have you guys thought about that?
Not until now, thanks.
No, definitely. Especially when you look at photo albums and everything, you see it's either you and your mom, you and your dad, or just the three of you.
Yeah.
And you just really see it's your own little world, and it becomes really evident then.
And even siblings who don't get along, they're still, you know, you're bound by that shared experience. What your parents were like, what they did, how they behaved, what you did in your time away from them, you know, what you were like at 5 and 10. There's somebody else who knows that, who knows you that kind of intimately.
That was Phyllis Owens there, along with Angela Kim and Mark Sanchez. And this feature of an only childhood made me feel sad for my friends and sad for me as well. The first Christmas after our wedding, my wife and I went to Arkansas to the Ozark Mountain cabins that our family used to own. And I showed her the rock formations that my siblings and I had explored and named. And we trespassed at the old swimming hole where my brother showed me how to skip stones. And we found a rusted tin cup that my sisters had used for tea parties 30 years ago. We had a great time. But, of course, the people who could have truly shared all that with me weren't there. And I didn't expect my brothers and sisters to come to Arkansas. They're busy with their own families. And anyway, I haven't exactly kept in close touch. I did invite them via email. In other words, I realized that I've been mentally planning my ideal family based on my childhood memories of people I now take for granted. So here's where I've gotten so far. The environmentalist in me says keep it small, maybe adopt. The part of me that loved the whole pregnancy thing the first time around says do it again. The part of me that's my wife is up for another, although she's surprisingly not keen on having 9. And mostly I feel back in touch with what a gift it is to have a family at all.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
One woman journeys to Antarctica and finds her soul on ice. Coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Last week, we brought you the story of Dance Dance Party Party, a judgment-free dance party / unstructured exercise class for women. Jane Goodman, who listens to us on WCPN in Cleveland, had a quibble with that story.
I love the story about the Chicago Dance Party, how it was a safe place where women could go to let go without making a public spectacle of themselves. That is, I loved it until I heard the ubiquitous, "You can see this on our website." Huh? Doesn't showing pictures of their party on the web completely negate the idea of a safe, private place?
An excellent point, Jane. Thank you for that. 2 weeks ago, our John Moe spoke with Chris Cashman, a comedian recently named Comic Wonder of the Year. Judy Jurgensen listens to us on WBEZ Chicago and sent in this suggestion for Mr. Cashman.
Comic Wonder said on your show that there is no punchline to "A horse walks into a bar." But my favorite joke is, a horse walks into a bar and the bartender says, "Why the long face?" Now that is funny.
Last week, our Good News, Bad News, No News panel sided with a school administrator's wife as she left this message laying out a teen who'd called her house to find out why they didn't get a snow day. Here's a clip.
"You don't begin to know what you're talking about, and don't you ever call here again."
Ouch. Strong words, but our panel liked them.
I like seeing her getting a good whack.
A verbal spanking.
No, it was minty and refreshing. I liked it.
Well, Fritz Geckner, who listens to us on WIUM in Iowa, did not like it. He, quote, "I was appalled that you took the opportunity to ignore the wife's behavior. Prejudice against young people is widespread and seems to be socially acceptable. Young people aren't perfect, but as a group, those I meet are as well or better behaved than their elders."
Now, what would have happened if someone had stopped and listened to that kid who had the complaint? I called Professor Gareth Matthews. He's an expert on children and philosophy. And I asked him, do we listen to kids enough?
Children make wonderful conversation partners. Young children often have interesting philosophical thoughts and even engage in interesting philosophical reasoning.
It strikes me as maybe we don't engage children because we don't know the answer. We feel challenged by those questions that we've had ourselves and don't know the answers to.
We assume because we've had so much more experience and we're so much older that we should be able to answer any question that a child can put to us. But that's silly. Instead of putting the child down or ignoring the question, why not think about it with the child? And maybe together you can come up with a good response.
Given the fact that you've documented that young people can, in fact, wax philosophical, when that high school student called the school administrator, what would have been a better response?
I don't know exactly what the student said, but the student presumably didn't show any respect for the director of education. If one wants students or anybody to learn respect for others, one must show them some respect. It would be well to engage the student on that issue rather than simply ball the student down.
I was wondering, what got you first interested in the subject of exploring the philosophical minds of children?
My older daughter was interested in the fact that the family cat Fluffy had fleas. And Sarah said, "Daddy, how did Fluffy get fleas?" And I said, "Oh, she was probably playing with another cat, and they jumped off that cat onto Fluffy." And Sarah thought a minute, and she said, "Daddy, how did the other cat get fleas?" And I said, "Oh, it was probably playing with another cat." Sarah said, "Daddy, it can't go on and on like that forever. The only thing that goes on and on forever is numbers." Here my 4-year-old daughter was presenting an argument from infinite regress for a first flea, and I thought, my goodness, philosophy begins at 4.
Well, Gareth, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Well, John Locke can think what he will. We believe you have the free will to be able to come to our website and let us know what you're thinking, and we promise to listen. It's weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, we welcome you to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is the show about what's happening this weekend all across America, like in New York, where the American Natural History Museum is celebrating a polar weekend. There are exhibits and lectures on polar bears, climate change, even a tutorial on how to build an igloo. One of the speakers is Anne Aguillon. She's talking about ice people of Antarctica. Now, ice people aren't as scary as they may sound. They're the scientists who do research in the deep freeze. Anne spent 4 months making a documentary about what it's like for the researchers.
I went with a crew of, there were three of us, and we were there for 4 months. We landed there in McMurdo, and it was very, very cold. It was still the winter. So we had maybe 4 hours of dusty sunlight every day, and we gained a half an hour of daylight every day that went by.
What's McMurdo like?
It was a wild experience. I mean, you know, it's prefab buildings and a lot of wires, and it smells like diesel.
So you arrive fully prepared for what you think you're going to need to make a film about these people. What surprised you most? What were you not prepared for?
You're not prepared for the idea that you're so remotely away from the world, the idea that you're closed in and there's nowhere to go, and the cold, the beauty, the scale of things is unbelievable. Everything is way bigger than you ever imagined. We went, so about a week after we arrived, we went to survival school, and it was September 1st. It was the coldest time they'd ever done this. It was minus 50 or minus 60 or something like that. And you're thinking, what am I doing here exactly, you know, camping in minus 60 degrees? But you know that it's only one night, and then you're going to go back to the warmth of, you know, your dorm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a couple of months later, we went up into the field, into the dry valleys. And you get there and you're like, wait a minute, I was getting used to things before and now I'm in minus 25. You know, I'm going to be in minus 25 for 7 weeks. How am I going to go through this?
How did you go through that?
Well, the first couple of weeks were brutal. And the idea that I had to make a film in this environment was crazy. We would get our cameras ready, and it would take us maybe 2 or 3 hours to get ready. And by the time we'd get to wherever we were going, which was maybe, you know, 500 yards away, we'd try to push the button to record something, and then the batteries have, you know, were dead, or it was just nonstop.
So are you cold all the time?
Yeah, you're cold. At the beginning, you're cold all the time, and you have to keep moving because otherwise your toes get cold and your fingers get cold.
Well, so how do you sleep?
Well, you fill bottles with hot water at night. You put them in a sock, so you put one at your feet and one between your legs closer to your core. And very often I would wake up around 2 in the morning or something like that and have a piece of chocolate. It's like instant fuel.
Your body must be just working overtime, just trying to keep warm.
Yes. You know, you drink enormous amounts, you eat enormous amounts, and the other thing you have to do is pee, because you need to get rid of that liquid.
So did you have a flap in your snowsuit or something?
Well,
like, how complicated could that be?
Complicated. I had a little funnel that allowed mm-hmm. me to pee like a guy. And I peed into a bottle because we were in a very fragile environment. Anything that comes in has to go out.
That sounds like such a stressful life. Yeah. How did you deal with that stress?
You know, for me, it was extraordinarily peaceful. And yes, it's stressful on the body, but it was very peaceful, this limitation of choices. You know, the idea that you're there and you're just doing what you're doing, and you have to make sure that you don't break a leg and that you keep warm and that you make your film.
Well, Anne, thank you for sharing your experience with us. We look forward to the film.
Well, thank you.
Anne's movie, Ice People, won't be out for a year, but today and tomorrow she'll be talking about her experiences in Antarctica at the American Museum of Natural History. And you can see photos of Anne and that beautiful Antarctica landscape, the Dry Valleys. Just go to our website at weekinamerica.org.
This is the first weekend of Black History Month, and while black comedians have observed that their month is the shortest of the year, at least it's longer than the old Black History celebration. Here is Dr. Lisbeth Gant Britton, professor of African American Studies at UCLA, talking about the reaction that Carter G. Woodson got when he first proposed honoring the achievements of African Americans.
He said in 1926, we should have Negro History Week. Well, people were shocked. That was considered a very radical thing because at the time they said, you mean there's an entire week's worth of material? Some people couldn't even imagine what you could talk about for a whole week in terms of African-American accomplishments.
Dr. Gant Britton is with us now. Professor, how would you say Black History Month has changed since it started in the 70s?
After Black History Month was developed, emphasis was still on a few key figures such as Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and people who had done many things to try to bring African Americans into the American national consciousness. Since then, those figures, as well as key figures from the civil rights movement like Dr. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and others, have continued to be a prime focus. But beyond that, we have had the opportunity to do so much more research on many other aspects of the relationship of African Americans to the United States and Africa, that if you go around the country, you can find all kinds of wonderful things happening during Black History Month that really include contemporary achievements, research back to ancient Africa, and so many other aspects.
Tell us about some of that newer research that interests you.
For example, way back in the 12th century, the University of Timbuktu, which still exists, at the mosque in Sankore, had 25,000 students in the 12th century. So sometimes this idea that quote-unquote academics is white seems to prevail in some schools. But when students find out that we too can claim this amazing heritage of learning, I think it's really motivating.
How do the students react when they learn about a university in Timbuktu?
Oh, they're totally skeptical. They say, oh, Dr. Britton, you're kidding. They don't believe me.
Why not?
Because it's not in the standard history books, which is one of the reasons why a lot of us say that African American history and Black History Month is not just for African Americans. Everybody needs to know this.
How did you react to Black History Month when you studied that curriculum in school?
When I first encountered it, I was like many students. I felt ashamed to have a history book that only had a couple of pictures of African Americans who were slaves. They looked poor. They looked downtrodden. They looked miserable. And this wasn't something that was very motivating to me. So to participate in Black History Month and find out about contributions of amazing people made me feel amazing. It made me feel like I could do amazing things.
For how long, Doctor, should America have a separate Black History Month?
As long as we don't have complete inclusion in our so-called standard U.S. history classes, taking that extra time to make sure that students from all backgrounds at least get a rudimentary knowledge is really important. For example, in our elections today, we have the opportunity for an African-American candidate to be taken very seriously, in part because Black History Month has been around for as long as it has.
Why do you think there's such a sense of surprise at the success of Barack Obama's candidacy?
African Americans who excel are considered to be the exception. They're special. They're the stars. And so there is a way in which they are categorized differently from the rest of the population. So this is great from the standpoint of acknowledging Barack Obama as an individual, but it's unfortunate as far as historians are concerned if we take it in a context in which this exceptionalism seems to place the majority of African Americans in an inferior position.
Dr. Britton, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Lisbeth Gant Britton is a professor and student affairs officer at UCLA and is the author of a history textbook called Holt, African American History. All this month at our website, we will be posting little-known facts about black history, so come see us at weekendamerica.org.
Temperatures are going to be 13 degrees above average in the east this weekend, ranging from the 20s in northern Maine to the 60s in some areas in Virginia. For more weather, here's Week in America's John Moe.
Gourds have many uses, bowls for soup, birdhouses, but racing vehicles? Only in Casa Grande, Arizona, where clouds and 66 degrees greet the annual running of the gourds. Gourds converted to race cars and boats judged on speed and appearance. We eagerly await an event where race cars are filled with soup, but that has not been scheduled as of press time. In Aurora, Minnesota, they're literally letting things slide. It's the Laskiainen Finnish Sliding Festival held amid snow and 23 degrees. In the Finnish tradition, teams on toboggans shout out rhymes wishing for good turnip crops as they plummet downhill. My favorite rhyme? Let the turnips be nice and big for all of us to enjoy. Oh my God, here comes a tree. Ah! Sun and 61 degrees in Laurinburg, North Carolina. Or is it? The Boldface Liars Showdown features contestants trying to outdo each other's boasts and fibs. It is not part of the presidential primary season. The Liars will be judged by five-time lying champion Bill Lepp. At least he said he was a five-time champion. Hey, wait a minute, Lepp. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America. Are you weighing your Super Tuesday vote this weekend? We have made some music to inspire you, and it's next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by LendingTree, helping customers find the fixed-rate loan that's right for them. You can choose from up to four offers today, 1-800-555-TREE or at LendingTree.com. When banks compete, you win.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and we're getting ready for Super Tuesday this weekend by paying musical tribute to this smorgasbord of democracy.
Well, that song from earlier this hour, from Heart to Palm, UK, that's still rattling around in my head.
Super Tuesday. Okay, now it's the Mountain Goats' turn. John Darnielle is the man behind that band, the Mountain Goats. He's been recording for 17 years, yet has not done a single Super Tuesday song to date. This is called Down to the Ark.
Met up in North Dakota, and they donned their black robes. There in the chapel hall they said a brief invocation to their cloven-hoofed prince, and they signed their names in blood on the vestry wall. You know there's neither high nor low, and the void will claim all creatures small or bright. Seal up the borders or let everybody in the order of the serpent. There'll be neither left nor right, and we pull down our blindfold. Reach out for the lever in the dark. Get a sticker for our shirts as we head into the sun, proudly bearing the mark, headed down to the ark. Accent coach to teach him the Western twang, and several postborn babies learned the hard way. Vampires only kiss you, and they've sharpened up their fangs. Yeah. And as Minnesota fell, so went Missouri. VFWs in the snow, and we voted down the tax codes, and we voted down the war. So many names to choose from, just one way to go, and we pull down our blindfolds. Reach out for the lever in the dark. Get a sticker for our shirts as we head into the sun, proudly bearing the mark, headed down to the ark.
It's John Darnielle from the Mountain Goats. My songs have never been me expressing my feelings, or very rarely. They're formal exercises, you know, and I thought that was an interesting way of putting it. Things tend to be more interesting if you take them to the extremes, I think. Either you're a really good political satirist and you can do something that is poking fun but at the same time not being partisan, you know, or you can't. And I wouldn't, that's just sort of not what I do. I write little emotional psychodramas. So, you know, once I got my hook that I was going to portray all the candidates as, you know, people who drink the blood of infants, that was exciting to me, you know, because that's sort of my political position. I mean, I will vote for the person who comes closest to what I think is right, but I don't trust or like any of them. So once I had my hook, then I was kind of excited about it. The conceit of the chorus is going to the voting booth, and as you leave the voting place, they give you a little sticker that says "I voted." Right, the booth is kind of dark, and you go out into the light. And I sort of liked that sort of image from Revelations of people walking around with something on their foreheads, that proclaims that they've declared allegiance to the beast and so forth.
Reach out for the lever in the dark. Get a sticker for our shirts as we head into the sun. Proudly bearing the mark, headed down to the ark.
I try not to say that we shouldn't bother voting. I mean, I felt that way for a long time, I believe I'm voting for the person who's going to do the least harm almost all of the time, But I remain deeply suspicious of anybody who would seek public office.
Welcome to John Darnielle's world. There he was performing and discussing his Super Tuesday song called Down to the Ark. His band, the Mountain Goats, have a new album coming out February 19th called Heretic Pride. You can find out more about that and some more takes on Super Tuesday songs at weekendamerica.org.
Well, I'm not sure I'd get John to compose a Valentine's love song for me, but Valentine's Day is almost here.
This is true. Des, if my kid's birthday is right before Valentine's Day, that means I'm off the hook, right?
I wouldn't try it, Bill. Valentine's Day is the day when we show love to the people that we have that special word for, that pet name. Like, I know a teenager who calls her mom Booshams. I think that's so cute. And my son calls his little sister Smeagol, which is not as cute, especially now that she's 17.
My wife and I have a pet name for each other that involves facial features and radio microphones, and it's just too complicated to explain.
Well, what are your terms of endearment? Share them with us. Come to weekendamerica.org.
And that's another hour of Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Download a free podcast of our program at weekendamerica.org. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
On the next Weekend America, music is such an important part of the weekend. Some of our best memories are tied to a song.
To this day, when I hear the Youngbloods play Let's Get Together, I close my eyes and I'm back in 1970 on top of a Ferris wheel overlooking the grounds of 50,000 hippies.
Maybe best isn't exactly the right word. The Youngbloods, A Dream Girl, and 50,000 Hippies on the next Weekend America. Join us.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.